like throwing a leg over the ball, just quiet.
Oh, he might be out of play for a little while.
Yes, hello and welcome to Footballed, the Baldcast, the Wednesday edition of the Fox Football Podcast. Quick roll call, Brenton Speed.
In the house.
Andy Harper.
Present.
Murray Shaw, present as well. This week on the show, Adelaide have shown Marco Kurtz the Ausgang. And we'll look at where they're headed from here. Harps got egged on the weekend by Shaun Harrison. We'll check how Harps is feeling about all of that. The Mariners are going to win the competition, apparently. At Speedy has cast his eye over the Ollie Roos and he's wondering why Ben Fulami isn't there. And a 48-team World Cup is great news for the people, Harps, of Sao Tome and Principe, who are certain to qualify for the 2022 edition, which will be staged over 23 weeks in countries such as Qatar, UAE, Oman, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Iran and Iraq. As someone famously said, more of everything. Now, you two have spent, yet again, a lot of time together over the weekend. And, Speedy, a little trait of Andy Harper's you picked up on.
Yeah. We're driving to Adelaide's home ground, Cooper's Stadium, and I was just taken aback. I'm just trying to relax into the passenger seat and Harps is the driver. And he's got one hand on the seatbelt. And he's pushing the seatbelt all the way to the steering wheel with the thumb. And after 500 metres of the journey, it got the better of him. I said, what are you doing, Harps? And Harps said, what?
What were you doing, Harps?
That's your story, Speedy. Finish it off.
Well, Harps said that he was worried. He just ironed his shirt, spent a lot of invaluable time ironing his shirt, which is going to be presentable on air. And he feared that the seatbelt would cause so much damage to the look of the shirt that it would need to be ironed again or something. I mean, is this something anyone else in the world has ever dealt with? Any Baldcast listeners, have they ever been worried about the seatbelt causing friction or dramas to the shirt and needing to iron when you arrive at work?
As viewers of Fox Football and listeners to this podcast would know, Andy Harper is a man of sartorial elegance. And he would have picked up this trait, I'd imagine, off Michael Zappone, who would never, ever let a seatbelt.
He was in the back seat. He couldn't believe it.
But did he have the cross-shoulder one, or maybe he just had the lap belt? Does Zappers just call for the lap belt?
Nice carve-up, Steve.
Can you defend yourself?
Well, it's a nice carve-up from Speedy. He gets full marks for the carve-up. But I must say, in return, Speedy's up in the grand final of the worst backseat drivers in the history of man.
Well, he said he was in the passenger seat, to be fair to him.
Whatever. You know what I mean. And actually, from the backseat, he's still in the passenger seat, if you know what I mean.
Does he commentate as you're driving? Harper looks left, goes right, turns.
Yes. Oh, magnificent. Yes. But the other point about Speedy is, I'm not surprised he's observant enough to pick up that particular foible of mine, and it is true. I do try to protect the appearance of a freshly ironed shirt purely for the sake of television, not for any reasons of vanity. But someone as professional as B Speed and Belford, you and I both know that when it comes to being a professional sportscaster, is pretty close to top of the tree, if not at the top. Yet his level of professionalism obviously doesn't extend to how good he presents on television, obviously. I mean, why would he be so offended by someone trying to protect the appearance of a freshly ironed shirt?
I'm just worried that the South Australian police are going to go, isn't that defeating the purpose of the seatbelt? We're going to slap you with a fine. I mean, is this possible?
No, I feel pretty safe on that matter, Speedy, that the seatbelt was definitely engaged. And the fact that it was just being held just a few millimetres off my shirt.
A few millimetres? The steering wheel. Geez, you're all cramped up over the steering wheel, are you?
Any rate, it was a nice carve-up, Speedy, and we've all got our foibles that we deliver to entertain those around us, and I'm glad I've served.
Just quickly, Harps, and please do this in a short period of time. Tell us how Brenton Speed prepares for a game. He is one of Australia's leading commentators.
Yeah. Well,
is he in, is it a yoga type scenario? Is he cross-legged on the floor of the commentary box with his palms faced up saying, may me, my, mo, moo? How does he prepare?
There's a little bit of kumbaya going on. Mm-hmm. But there's, he's definitely no conservationist, B-Speed. Let's put it that way. There are Amazonian rainforests full of paper littered across the commentary box. And this, I mean, I've just become used to it, Belford, as you probably have too. But this really came home to be a couple of weeks ago. I'd hosted some foreign students at the Sydney University who came to the A-League game, and as a couple of them got into the commentary box to see how the professionals did it. And they really enjoyed it. And I've got to thank Speedy and Robbie, who were the two working on the night, for being so gracious in hosting these people from Europe and the United States. But one of the guys out of Norway was elbowing his mate as Speedy was in full cry, rifling through paper as he was calling the action. And this guy from Norway could not believe that someone actually still hand-wrote notes. He was elbowing his mate saying, can you believe this? In hushed tones, of course. This bloke, this dinosaur, this old bastard still handwrites notes. So we got off there, it was half-time. Speedy took him aside and said, mate, if I was to be young and hip, what would I do? Would I be putting my notes on an iPad or something and referring to that? That's just a long-winded answer to Speedy needs to get a bit greener.
Right. Speedy, take it away. Your weekly Brazzales.
Sure. What a fabulous feature piece that was that ultimately got to air on Jared Gillett.
Rhymes with Philip.
Yeah, all round fabulous stuff. And that's had a big win social media-wise overseas, has it?
Yes, it's been picked up by, well, certainly BT Sport in the UK. And it's got about 2 million views now, and all of them extremely positive. A lot of it along the lines of, wouldn't you love to be able to hear what they're saying every game? And also, as you and I have discussed off air, Speedy, a great advertisement for Jared Gillett and what a great referee he is. Harps, you would have seen that 3-minute feature.
Yeah, I did.
What'd you make of it?
Outstanding. Outstanding. Of course, that's just going to increase the clamour for mic'd-up referees, which is something I know, Belford, you've been trying to champion on the local front, that you come up against the not insignificant opposition from the likes of FIFA on that matter, and I can understand
why. It makes them human. It makes them human.
Yeah, I can understand why FIFA resist, but when you see what we put to air and what you organised and engineered through Jared Rhymes with Philip Gillett, outstanding television and an outstanding insight into the mechanisms of refereeing, it was fabulous.
So let's give that a posthumous one vote.
Chris, let's hope it's not dead, Speedy.
He's not dead.
Remains alive.
He's just moved to the UK.
It was 3 weeks ago, though. Chris Griffiths-Jones, for the VAR ruling on the Kennedy save and then the Georgievski putback, I think a lot of people...
What a surprise you could get KGJ.
...may have ignored that, so let's give him a couple of votes. The Roy Krishna red card is an interesting one for me. The first yellow card was criticised. Did the second yellow card come... Like, Alex King blew the whistle... late, very late, after the swinging arm. Was he tipped up by VAR? And can you tip up for a second yellow becomes a red? No, you can't.
You can't tip up for a yellow.
No.
So you did the VAR get involved there? That was a straight red.
Yeah, did the VAR get involved there?
I'm not sure.
I get the feeling it did.
Do you think I got that impression, Speedy, yeah.
Yeah, so I think they may have erred there.
Was it the VAR, or could have just been the linesman who was actually closer to the incident?
Yeah, he didn't wave the flag with any vigour either, which suggests that he's seen a cautionable offence. So
I don't actually have a problem with that second yellow. I mean, I know it's often everyone says, you know, Roy Krishna doesn't have that in him, but he's got a player on his back that he's trying to lose and he's hit him with an elbow.
Yeah, well, I think the VAR is entitled to say that's a straight red. And that's maybe what they should have done.
Yeah.
And then just give the straight red rather than the second yellow. So, Alex King, I'm going to give you a zero and just go back to the drawing board and just have a little think about whether you should use VAR in that sense. Just a little tickle up.
Yeah, fair enough.
And here we go.
This is significant. This is significant because Alex King, in the eyes of Speed B, is the new poster boy. and he's just demoted him. In this game of refereeing snakes and ladders, King's back to square one. No, but a big call from Speed.
That's beautiful coaching from Speed because, you know, it can't be all praise, Harps. Occasionally, you've just got to remind them, put them back in their place, and then he'll build him up again next week.
Yeah. Can I raise the spectre of that, and I agree with you on the KGJ with the Georgievski penalty conversion off the rebound. Is it safe to assume then that if a defender encroached along with a striker and the defender got to the ball first... And put the striker off from finishing it off, he would have replayed that as well? Is that safe to assume? Or is it because it went in that the VAR intervenes? And if that's the case, then I'm a little bit angry.
Can
what do you reckon?
I think you're talking about the right kind of thing. I think because the goal was scored, they pull it back and don't want to be seen to be letting that stand. Whereas, like you say, if the defender and attacker both go in, the defender clears it, I don't think we're going back for encroachment.
Well, that's wrong.
So there should be zero encroachment.
There should be zero encroachment. And if a defender, by encroaching, stops an attacker who's encroaching, it shouldn't just be right play on. It should be retaken.
Yeah, and if a defender encroaches and the goal is scored, obviously you just give the goal.
Yeah,
so the
yeah.
only that's the only situation that would lead to a no retake is if yep. a player scores and only the defender has infiltrated. Yep. What if a defender and attacker both infiltrate and the goal is scored? You just give it?
Well, from the penalty.
Yeah.
Yeah, you just play on.
Okay, we're getting bogged down. 3-2-1, Brazilis.
Yeah, and Mike Callaghan.
Who?
Watching the NBA, yes.
Harry Callaghan?
While we're on the referee front. 29th year in the NBA, and you still don't know what constitutes a jump ball.
So we have now jump sports.
Seth Curry v. Tyreek Evans, and he just made up a decision, and he looks like he's old and tired. So if there's any connections via the broadcast that can get to Mike Callaghan via 6 degrees of separation, then give him a little tickle up and say, Mike, it's time to pack it in or just get a bit more cheery with your job because you're an absolute gibberer. Mike Callaghan, 29th year in the NBA. And NBA officials wind me up more than football officials.
I'm writing this down. Brazilis are now officially under review. Going forward, because we've moved on from talking about football officiating to now doing NBA officiating.
But it just shows that you can get tired in the refereeing game.
I'm going to talk to KGJ in the VAR room, and we're going to review this segment.
And there's more than a passing hint of ageism in this as well, so a double sanction for speed.
All right. We'll meet during the week and perhaps undergo a survey or something like that, and we'll discuss whether this is coming back for next week. Righto, players you enjoyed watching over the last week. Let's start with you, Harps. Eric Boetiak.
Yeah, well, partly because we haven't spoken much about Brisbane in a positive sense this year, and partly because I don't know if anyone's really specifically referred to Eric Boetiak in particular, but in the shambles that Brisbane season has ended up being, I want to give an acknowledgement to Boetiak. He had a couple of flashpoints this year, one of which was a red card against Melbourne Victory, which was part of the early slide of Brisbane. But I think he's regained ground well, and I just want to give him I just want to acknowledge that, you know, we're watching and we appreciate what he's been trying to do in a positive sense and some of the quality he's brought to this difficult season. And I guess what I'd like to throw open to you guys is he the type of guy you'd keep in the league, keeping in mind that he's really only been at Brisbane for their two really troubled seasons? If they were an A-League force like they have been, could you see Boetiak actually being an even brighter light for Brisbane Roar?
Yes, and my understanding is that he's got clubs in Sydney and Melbourne who are interested in his signature for next season. And I think he, and particularly if you look at the other imports in the Brisbane side, he's probably the one you'd keep out of that. Like, I'm with you, Harps. Let's see how he goes in a great side.
Mm. Yeah, but let's make sure he's, you know, earning, for argument's sake, $250,000, $300,000. He's not a marquee.
No. I'm not suggesting he's a marquee.
He's just under the cap.
Yep.
He's a reasonably well-paid foreigner, but he's not big money.
If the argument is the foreigners need to be able to do more than the locals, which is what we've talked about on this pod many times before, then I'd say he does deliver that.
Yes, I agree with that.
Who are you going for, Murray?
I'm going with Max Burgess, another player out of the NPL who I think is another player who's blossomed under the coaching of Mark Rudan. Straight out of Sydney Olympic, good with both feet, and he's a creative player. And I love watching creative players. And I'm very much enjoying the progress of Max Burgess at the Wellington Phoenix. What about you, Speedy?
I was going to go with Costa Barbarousis. Two goals, might have scored five. The celebration, if you can call it that, for his first goal was well thought out and perfect little tribute to the victims of what happened in Christchurch. But I'm going to go with Matt Miller because he's missed out here and he deserves praise. In the Mariners' first win in a long time under Alan Stajic, playing in the right-back role, if you don't mind, getting up and down and involved in the first two goals from memory. Absolutely brilliant player, and he's playing against his future employers as well. So what kind of mindset did he go into that game with against the Newcastle Jets? And some people are throwing it out there. Matt Miller, is he good enough to be in the Socceroos calculations? That is it's a massive shout because it's a Mariner, and we you know they're often underrated the performances they put in. But how would he look alongside some top class personnel in the Socceroos setup?
I like a big early call, but I'm not going with you on that. I'd still want to see more of him before he's coming into calculations for the Socceroos. Your thoughts, Harps?
Yes, I'm mightily impressed with Matt Miller. I wouldn't be putting him in any Socceroos discussion at the moment.
What's he got to work on? What's he got to work on?
Well, consistency.
My point about Matt Miller is I hope he gets moved up the field. I actually don't see him as a right fullback, and he's done a great job there. But I would love to see Matt Miller terrorising defences from the get-go, central defenders, because he's non-stop, he's a lump of the lad, he's going to be a handful. And if he can, if he was coming into my stable, I'd be looking to convert him into a centre forward, to be honest. I'm not sure what he's like in front of goal on a consistent basis. We've seen him marauding down the flank, and I agree with the assessments. He's been a really bright point on the Mariners' awful season. And if I was recruiting him, and I'm Newcastle, and I'm thinking I'm bringing him here not as a right fullback, I'm bringing him here as an attacking player. I think he can be a very, very difficult player to handle.
That move down the right wing when he turned some defenders inside out was absolutely phenomenal. I think the Jets have bought him as an attacking player, and good luck to him.
We'll get to Newcastle in just a minute. You mentioned the tribute from Costa Barbarousis to the victims of the atrocities in Christchurch last week. Also, congratulations to Wellington Phoenix for that touching tribute at the start of the game with Western Sydney, particularly Andrew Durante putting his arm around Tariq Elric, which I thought was really symbolic, and some really nice words too from Mark Rudin, the Wellington Phoenix coach, after the game as well. Well done to the A-League. Speaking of the A-League, the big news in the last 24 hours, Harps, has been the sacking, I guess, if you like, of Marco Kurtz, with the chairman of Adelaide United, Pete Vanderpoel, saying his contract won't be renewed for next season. He was employed, I guess, under the previous regime, and clearly it would seem that the chairman and him don't see eye to eye on where the club is heading. Unlucky, or how do you view it?
Well, I mean, obviously this happens in football, so there's no news in this. I mean, we're expecting this, really, with the lack of communication between the two, the lack of movement on Kurtz by the club was all pointing to this outcome. So there's no surprise. And the club completely within their rights. So support them on that. However, they have put themselves right in the firing line now because they have a good coach on their books at the moment, a very good coach in my opinion. If you're not going to continue down that path with Marco Kurtz, which is completely your prerogative, for the sake of the fans, you better make damn sure the replacement is as good or better. That puts the club, in my opinion, under enormous pressure.
Speedy?
Big time. And what is going on with the ownership there? There was a great article written of mystery and intrigue because Pete Vanderpoel is the public face, but no one knows who's in that ownership group, really. And does the FFA need to make sure with this modern day transparency that we know who the owners are and why this sort of mystery and intrigue is surrounding so many of the decisions made as well? The talk from Val Migliaccio as his ear close to the ground in Adelaide, of course, is that they're going to bring in a Dutch coach because that's who they know.
Yeah, Hups, you were at the FFA's briefing last week, and this was touched on by Val about should we know who the owners is. I can actually understand why the FFA don't want to name who these owners are, and I'll go into that in a moment. What's your take on it?
Yeah, look, I'm with you. What we gleaned from that, Belford, was that the FFA know full well who the owners are. The FFA bow to the wishes of these owners that their ownership doesn't become public. And as far as I'm concerned, that's the end of the story. We're trusting, of course, that FFA have done the requisite due diligence and fit and proper people's test on this ownership group. And if it's passed muster, then I just think we get on with the football and I'm happy with that decision. If the club becomes dysfunctional, that becomes an issue for the governing body. More importantly, it becomes an issue for the owners in their relationship with their fans. And to be frank, they're at one of those crossroads now. How do you replace a very good coach and find an adequate very good coach or better? It's a very difficult assignment. And that's when the pressure will build on these owners. And you would have to think that the these are my words, not anyone else's, but this is my opinion. The relative underinvestment in this team all seems to be a function of not supporting this coach and making sure that when his time's up, he goes without financial penalty for us, with players we don't want and a coach we don't want. So now, not only do they have to find the right coach to replace, then they have to back this coach with resources from this consortium that are going to actually catapult Adelaide back to the top of the reckoning, which is where they should be. So it's a double-pronged bit of pressure for this ownership group. That's the way I see it.
Yeah, just going back to that Adelaide ownership issue, if Brenton Speed, it was suddenly discovered, had invested in an A-League club, I would be thinking to myself, wow, Speedy's got some money, doesn't he? I didn't realise he had that sort of money. Mm. If Speedy doesn't want people to know he's got lots of money because he's worried about the safety of his family or he's worried about 1,000 people hitting him up for a loan, then Speedy says, I'm happy to invest in such and such a club, but I don't want it known that I've invested in that club. I love the club, or I love this, or I've got some money I want to give to Australian football, et cetera, et cetera. But I want to keep it on the down low. I've got absolutely no problems with that, and I can understand why a lot of rich people wouldn't want people knowing that they're rich. Mm.
The old lottery winner syndrome.
Exactly, exactly.
Are you suggesting, Belford, that Brenton Speed would pass the fit and proper persons test?
I'm suggesting Brenton Speed won't be giving his money to a football club, but that's another issue.
Before we move on from Adelaide, can I send a big, big cheerio, and I hope this gets through to him, to Nick Bianco. Nick Bianco, a former owner of Adelaide United, indeed was in charge when Adelaide broke very new ground for Australian football by making the final of the Champions League in 2008. Great owner of the club, unfortunately fell on harder times and had to relinquish that ownership. And my cheerio to Nick Bianco is that every time I'm at Cooper Stadium calling an Adelaide game, I see Nick Bianco there, cheering on the club that he loves. And the fact that he no longer owns it has obviously not taken away from his support for what football in Adelaide is trying to do, and I want to send a big cheerio to Nick for that.
A great owner who was loved by the football department and loved by players as well, and if I remember, was loved by the media, because I think once a week, didn't he used to put on lobsters for the wow, media at training to get them along? So, yes, credit to Nick Bianco. Moving away from Adelaide Harps, you touched on the Mariners-Newcastle game a little earlier, but you were quite disappointed with what you saw from the Jets. Do you care to expand?
Yeah, well, I mean, before I launch onto that, I think I speak for a lot of people in saying good on the Mariners for aiming up. And
100%.
That great shot of one of the goals that was scored that went to the knot of Mariners fans who turned up to support their team, of old mate with his shirt off,
Mariner's and tat over his heart.
That Mariner's tat over his heart. Now, that needs to be cut up and whatever and sent to Mike Charlesworth and said, mate, this is what you're playing with here. And indeed, the boffins at FFA and the new league working model need to see that image as well, because this is what these clubs mean to people and they're not to be toyed with, right? It was a great shot and well done to the Mariners. Mate, what a letdown for Newcastle. I think this performance from the Jets kills their season. They were building ahead of steam. In fact, going into this match, over the last five or six rounds, they were the top team in the comp. With so much at stake against your so-called fiercest rivals, to have delivered such a flat, anemic performance was almost unforgivable. Forget the late flurry, which was hugely exciting. The question has to be asked of this team, why they couldn't deliver that intensity from the start in a match that would have put them 1 point behind Melbourne City. Of course, events the day after contrived to widen that gap because of City's win over Sydney. But Newcastle weren't to know that, and maybe that extra pressure on Melbourne City might have caused them to hiccup. It was a horrible, horrible miscalculation for the Jets, and I don't know if they can make it from here.
How badly were Newcastle affected by losing three players? Was it Katrumbas, Champness and Vuitsa to the Ollie Roos? Were they one of the clubs that could feel a little aggrieved from the weekend?
Well, I think so. I think this whole exercise in Malaysia with taking these players out, to me it's, I've come to the view that whilst the players should be taken for qualifying games, I just think this unnecessarily nobbled various A-League teams. Newcastle could be one of those. Maybe those players would have made a difference. I just think generally the atmosphere around that team goes against that argument on the weekend. But the separate issue, Marz, if you're looking to branch out and out into that, is that I don't think a cobbled together preparation for these Olympic qualifiers, Asian qualifiers, on the back of a system which needs a massive reworking, why do we compound the problems of that by taking away for the A-League for that week of football? I don't get it. I think it was a mistake. I think it is a mistake. It needs to be revisited.
Let's stick with you, Ollie Roos, now that we've gone down that path. I mean, Bozza made comments on A-League Hour about the gross disrespect, or as he put it, the gross disrespect.
Is that leftovers from Johnny Sieben's battle with Michael Gross?
Michael Gross.
In the 80s?
With the big arms.
2 metre wingspan.
2 metre wingspan. Was it the albatross?
Yeah, like, the albatross.
The albatross.
Do you think Bozza's just loved that battle so much that he thinks gross is gross?
Channeling a bit of Laurie Lawrence. From, was it 1984?
84.
Yeah, Lucky Lane 7.
Duncan Armstrong.
Lucky Lane 6.
Lane 6 for Sieben, I think. Yeah,
Sieben and Armstrong, both Lucky Lane 6.
So Bozza had a bit of a go at it as well. I mean, I don't think anyone's criticising the fact that players should be released to play in these qualifying tournaments. I think Bozza's point was more, did they need to be there that early and miss a game from the A-League that weekend? What's your take on that, either of you?
Well, you want them to go into this three games in 6 days sort of scenario in the actual tournament proper with no lead-in games then, because that's what you're saying. You're saying Graham Arnold isn't entitled to take them away and build to this tournament that we haven't qualified for since 2008 when Arnie took them to Beijing. So they missed out on London, missed out on Rio. And now the importance of putting in a good showing and making sure we get through this phase and win at least two of these games in Cambodia. I think Arnie's done the right thing. They missed one A-League game. Unfortunately, some teams are weakened. Johnny, the names you mentioned earlier, Johnny Katrumbas is about the only one who's starting regularly. Champness has just come back into the fold. Would have been maybe a 15-20 minute cameo man, and Vujica may have been a sub. So the Jets haven't missed out on much. And I think Graham Arnold is trying to do the right thing for Australia's junior development at that sort of age group. So good on him for making the big call and copping the backlash and getting on with it.
The qualifiers are Australia plays Cambodia midnight on Friday. Chinese Taipei, these times are Australian Eastern. Chinese Taipei Sunday at 9 p.m. And then the big one, South Korea, next Tuesday at 9 p.m. We'll watch those games and discuss them next week. Korea reportedly have had a one-month training camp throughout most of January and February, including 8 practice matches for this.
Because basically, their league wasn't on.
And they've only picked players out of the local league. They haven't got any of their foreigners involved.
Any of their K-League-based players, you mean?
So they've only picked K-League-based players. Okay, they haven't picked anyone from
overseas. In Bundesliga clubs or whatever.
Yeah, I think they've got a young player buying.
Let's move this on the Ollie Roos front. It was televised in Malaysia, this most recent game, the Ollie Roos against Malaysia. So there was a YouTube highlight reel. And I sent it out to you guys and I said, let's talk about it on the broadcast and get your impressions of how Australia played under Graham Arnold.
Harps?
Yeah, well, I saw the snippet you sent through, Speedy. Thanks for that. That we're not beating a Malaysian under-23 team. They look like they moved the bits I saw, moved the ball nicely, created some chances, bad finishing, blah, 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 same old story. Still should beat a Malaysian team. And my question about this whole thing is, qualify for the Olympics, qualify for Asia with these youth teams, great. I just need to know what it achieves. Does it make us all feel great? Because everyone is in unison that the domestic development system is busted. Right, so until we actually fix that, what do we get from these? What does it prove? We're putting a band-aid over the system. Oh yeah, it's now fixed because we've developed these players. I just think until we can all sit around and agree that we've bashed out the dents in this thing and we've now got a fully functional youth system. Why would you, until that's the case, why would you then also take away from the A-League in the meantime? I, to me, those arguments don't add up for the sake of qualifying for a tournament and then turning around and saying, yeah, what? So what? Unless someone can explain to me actually what we get out of qualifying for these tournaments without having paid due attention to the supporting structures, well, I don't get it.
Murray, what do you see in the highlights?
A bit like Harps. I think Australia were knocking the ball around nicely, getting the ball through the lines very well from midfield through to the front third. So Piscopo impressed me. McGree was good. Pasquale was good. Same old problems. We do need to find a striker, but we've been saying that since God was a boy. But they're playing some good football. Very clearly they died towards the latter stages of that game, probably due to the conditions over there. I'm told too also that the qualifying game is going to be played on a artificial pitch.
Which looks terrible.
So that probably brings them back to the field as well. Yeah. It's not going to be easy. You know, like we all think it's just going to be a cakewalk and we might struggle against South Korea, but we'll get past Cambodia and Chinese Taipei. I'm not quite so sure.
Yeah. So both of you have watched it and said the passing between the lines was fantastic. Mm. Same old story. The finishing is terrible. What is Australian football doing to fix finishing? We've got to find a finisher, a striker. I watch training a lot at various levels, and they work on all that build-up. They get it into wide areas. They get a fullback in behind. They cut it back, and then the expression is finish, finish. And then they shoot, and they often hit the keeper, straight to the keeper, and the keeper makes a save. The shooting has to be in the bottom corner, or also shots were blocked, and the good players around the world, they take an extra touch. They feign to shoot first time, they touch it a metre, shift it, and then sweep it in the bottom corners. There's not enough training on the final finish, even the warm-up for games. The cutback comes in, and they just shoot first time, as if that is ever rarely is that an option in the actual game to score a goal. The way teams are coached and in finishing needs to improve and needs to think a bit more laterally. That's the most important part. A lot of Australian teams, you've watched them over the last 10 years, they all play beautiful football. The teams that have qualified for under 20 World Cups, you know, it brings a tear to your eye the way they pass it around. They dominate possession in a lot of games, but then it gets to the final third and they can't finish. The training has to improve. Like from under 10s or whatever, put buckets in the bottom left-hand corner, you know, buckets, top bin and all this sort of stuff. Let people shoot to the bin. A lot of players shoot to the goalkeeper and say, I've got it on target. There's this expression, oh, I've got it on target. Finishing has to improve, and I don't see it improving when the mentality isn't there and the coaching isn't there.
Do some Googling, Speedy, on Michael Owen talking about why he was such a good finisher. It's very interesting. He basically says that he used to play in teams that used to flog other junior teams. So he had this phenomenal record at the junior level. He was scoring like 10 goals a game. Yeah. And everyone was like, well, why don't you play against tougher opposition? And he actually says at the time, he said, it was really good for me because I'd get that many chances to score that it was really helpful in a game situation to be able to get so many chances to finish. Do you have a take on that, Harp?
Yeah, I do. And look, Speedy's onto something. And 2 points. Firstly, a great person to ask about this is our national team coach, Graham Arnold. I mean, he's a striker by trade, made his career as a striker. He's been coaching very successfully in the A-League in charge of two very progressive clubs in the Central Coast and Sydney FC. What was he doing there? Why haven't those clubs produced an international class striker? That's point one. Point two, to your Michael Owen thing. On some of my tours internationally of self-education, I did notice in Brazil, watching the way they train their kids, and there was one theme, one of the many themes, but the one that's relevant to us. They would completely overload goal-scoring practices for the strikers. And it would be like maybe 5 against 2
yep.
from about 30 metres out from, or 40 metres out, start with a couple of passing exercises.
Yep.
And then it would be 5 against 2. And the two defenders, obviously, are getting a lot of work out of this. But it's completely loaded towards the strikers, so they're getting a lot of repetition. And these are very broad brush comments. They're getting a lot of repetition, and they're getting just enough resistance from overworked defenders to actually have to work on what the speed's talking about. You know, that final nuance, shifting the ball, taking that extra touch, whatever. And I left that visit to Fluminense, very impressed by how repetitive the whole thing was and how heavily loaded it was to the goal scorers. Now, we're presupposing that doesn't happen in our system. I'm not going to make quite that leap that Speedy's made. I'm sure there are people doing that. But I think this whole youth development system is a broader discussion. And in that broad discussion, we do need to get a little bit more specific on attacking in the penalty area. There's no question. And the people who are there now, let's ask them what they're doing. Why haven't the coaches who've been around for years produced one or two strikers? Who knows?
Harps, more to your point that you were making before about, you know, where are we going with qualifying for these tournaments? I thought to myself, okay, so the last time we qualified for the Olympics was Beijing 2008. Mm. If it's a stepping stone to giving players great international experience before they get to the Socceroos and then they have great careers with the Socceroos, I just thought to myself, well, let's have a look at that team and see how they progressed through the ranks of the senior side. So here's the starting team for the Oli Roos against the Ivory Coast, which was the final game of the Olympics. For the Oli Roos. So it was Adam Federici in goal, Trent McClenahan, Mark Milligan, Matt Spiranovic, Jade North, who, if I remember, was an overage player, David Carney, Billy Selesky, Stuart Musialik, Christian Sarkis, Nikita Rukavica, and Mark Bridge. So of that lot, Mark Milligan's obviously had an incredible Socceroos career. Matt Spiranovic, very good as well. David Carney had a great Socceroos career, but there's not a lot after that. So, you know, yes, it's a stepping stone, but how vital do you see it in terms of developing players for the senior Socceroos?
Well, not actually, because you've got to get the engine room right. But the thing about qualifying for the Olympic Games and other tournaments like that, historically for us, the value, firstly, has been for Australian football to stick its chest out and say, you know, we're mixing with the best, and that's fair enough. Mind you, in those days, we were qualifying through Oceania, and there wasn't the resistance to get there. Then the value kicked in. And what was the value for Australian football? Our best young players, as decided by the coach at the time, on the global shop, in the global shop window. And Australian football would benefit by the easy ride into qualifying for FIFA tournaments, and then at the FIFA under-20s or the Olympic Games, our best players then could get picked up by scouting networks overseas into the bigger clubs in Europe. They were the two benefits, right? You'd have to think now that the A-League presents as good a shop window now because it is a respected league overseas. And, well, we've got to deal with our need to get, you know, feel puffed up because our under-20s have qualified. Great, if you've got the engine room right first. And we quite plainly haven't. You won't find anyone in this country to say that the youth development system is polished like the Japanese one. I mean, why do they keep producing so many players? Because they've got their engine room right. And until we get the all our focus must be getting the engine room right, and then we can worry about these particular tournaments. That's just my opinion.
Harps and Speedy, should the Socceroos be playing this weekend? I noticed that Asian rivals Japan, South Korea have all got big games for their national teams. They're not taking a break after the Asian Cup. Given performances at the Asian Cup, would you have liked to have seen the Socceroos playing this weekend? Obviously, the attention is on the Oli Roos and making sure they get through this qualifying campaign.
I think I raised this very question just as Harps was thrusting the seatbelt to the wheel on the trip to Cooper Stadium. So I sort of got glossed over when we turned our attention to the seatbelt scenario. But it's worth bringing up now on the broadcast because, yeah, the Socceroos should certainly be playing this weekend. We've had a failure at the Asian Cup, couldn't knock off the UAE in the quarterfinal. So as defending champs, we only made it to the last eight, didn't make it to the last four or the final. So Graham Arnold had some work to do with that Socceroos squad, and now's when you should be doing the work. Yep. But he's doubling up as coach of the Oli Roos. So suddenly the Socceroos, just leave them on the back burner, give them a little chop out, give them a little rest, and we'll get onto that at some future date.
Yep, 100% agree. And the Socceroos should be playing this weekend. Graham Arnold should be looking after the Socceroos, and one of his assistants should be running this Oli Roos program. If we're going to double up our head coach, if we're not, you know, and that's the price you pay. But the Socceroos, the Asian Cup was a failure, unadulterated failure. And we can't. And if games are important, as coaches keep telling us, then why isn't there a game this weekend?
And clubs battled for a long time to have these international weekends clear of A-League. It finally happened this year, and we have the situation this weekend on the first weekend of the AFL, whereby there is no Socceroos games and no A-League games. It makes no sense.
No, it's wrong. It's wrong with a capital R.
Here's how they could have solved the problem too. Why not have the Socceroos in camp with the Olleroos?
Yep.
So rather than playing the Malaysian under-23s as a warm-up, could the Olleroos have played the Socceroos as a warm-up? The Socceroos could have gone off somewhere and played probably a practice game in Southeast Asia, and the Olleroos could have got on with their business of qualifying
for the Olympics. Socceroos couldn't play the Olleroos, because Socceroos wouldn't have come into camp until now.
Yeah, true. But they could have played them now, couldn't they? The game's not till Friday, so they could have got a warm-up in.
Wednesday? Might have been tough.
Yeah.
Well, let's delete that bit from Phil. Can you cut that bit out of the podcast?
What? I'm happy to be made to look stupid.
No.
It happens daily.
I appreciate the lateral thinking, Murray. Don't listen to the speed.
Speaking of a man who loves lateral thinking, it's the speed. Just quickly, Harps, I mentioned it at the top, Shayon Harrison, who we gave a little bit of a tickle up to last week because we were sort of questioning what Melbourne City saw in bringing him here, or what was the point, I guess, of bringing him here, but scored two goals. We didn't. Actually, one was given as an own goal, but was at his best, I guess, as Melbourne City upset Sydney last weekend. How is the egg on your face?
Well, it dried a lot quicker than that egg on Fraser Anning's face, but put it that way. Mate, if Shayon Harrison delivers Melbourne City the title, then I'll eat my words.
You'll eat the egg.
Well, I've done that already. It's not going to sit there. You know, it's not like a mud pack, Murray. It doesn't do anything for your skin. It's not an exfoliant, right?
They were beautiful goals, weren't they? Like the first goal,
first
terrific.
First
talk about finishing.
Yep.
It's as though he's worked on his finishing and said, all I have to do is place it in the bottom corner, which the Olleroos didn't do the other day with their umpteen chances against the Malaysian 11.
That's dawned on Shayon Harrison this week, Speedy, has it?
No, that's what I'm saying. Right. He's obviously worked on it on a training ground somewhere in the back blocks of England that I don't see being worked on the back blocks of Australian training grounds.
And it's taken him 6 weeks to access that part of his memory.
Well, it's a slow build. It's acclimatisation. He's got to get his house sorted out in Melbourne. There's a lot that goes on when you make a big move around the world, Harps, to settle down. So maybe he's just settled into his environment, feeling comfortable, and suddenly the goals come, including a lovely side-on, almost bicycle kick sort of scenario that gets the deflection in for the second goal. That was superb technique from Shayon Harrison. Maybe we'll look back in the years to come if Shayon Harrison becomes the next Harry Kane at Tottenham and say, what about the chance? We had the chance to watch him live in the A-League.
No, I'll never say that. The 2022 World Cup.
Spurs fan that you are.
Looks like it's going to be a 48-team World Cup. So 16 groups of three, you qualify for the World Cup and you might get two games. What do you make of it all, Harps?
Well, I was never a massive fan of it, but I've softened only because of the experience of the Asian Cup. I was certainly not looking forward to the expanded Asian Cup of this year. But, you know, the new teams that came in basically added a lot to the atmosphere of the tournament. So that's changed my thinking a little bit on expanding the World Cup. I'm still not completely convinced, but I'm more open than I was before. I don't know how it's going to work. The thing, and I might be late to this argument, but what's emerging now is this whole blockade against Qatar is less about geopolitics and terrorism and more about a certain countries in the Gulf wanting a piece of the World Cup pie. And so if that comes to pass, then it'll just underscore the cynicism with which a lot of these deals are done. But the only hope for an expanded World Cup, facilities-wise and logistics-wise, is to tack the UAE onto this. Now, I know Saudi are in the discussion as well, but I'm not quite sure logistically how fans getting in and out of Saudi is going to be a smooth operation for the sake of that World Cup. So
The other part of this, Harps, of course, is that this is a unique World Cup in that it's going to take place during a European season, and now with 48 teams, you think it's probably extended from 4 weeks to 5 weeks, which is a bit of an up yours to the sort of monopoly of world football of the big clubs in Europe from FIFA, wouldn't you say? And that probably leads us into the Club World Cup, which is another way of them saying, we run this game, not you.
Yeah, wouldn't that be a great way, actually? Maybe a bigger issue than this expanded World Cup, if there is such a thing, because we're talking about the biggest event on the planet, but Infantino's idea for a new format for the Club World Championship, which is a quadrennial, that's once every 4 years, 24-team battle between the best clubs on the planet on a confederation basis, similar sort of divvying up as the World Cup is. And guess who's the most mounting the most opposition to this? The European cartel. And are they a little bit nervous that something like a properly done Club World Cup every 4 years could actually challenge the Champions League in time as the preeminent club competition on the planet? Perish the thought. But for the sheer sake of breaking Europe's monopoly on everything that's considered in world football, I say good on you, FIFA, and go a bit harder till we've actually worked out where the bodies are buried on this.
Talk that the participating clubs in the Club World Cup could get something like $20 million for just qualifying. And there's also talk, so that'll be three teams in Asia, but one in Oceania. I tell you what, if you want to buy shares in a club, get shares in Team Wellington or Auckland City, who are probably going to qualify for the Club World Cup and take out $20 million every 4 years.
What will they spend it on?
A very good question. Will they share it around? New Zealand football could be about to take off.
On that 48-team World Cup, so 16 by 3, so top two go through and become a round of 32 in the knockout stage, does it?
No. Is that the idea? No. Is it top two go through or is it just top one and then it's 16,
it
8, 4?
I think it was top two and then you have 32 and then you can divide it down by twos from there.
Because otherwise you have one bad game and you're almost gone from the World Cup. Yeah. I've always liked the idea, Harps, and I'm sure you would too, is that once a World Cup with 32 teams finishes, they then use exactly the same stadia and we get the lowest ranked teams in the world to play for another World Cup. I've always liked the thought of watching Equatorial Guinea play Timor Leste after the buzz of the World Cup's just finished and you want more football and you get these teams that you never get to see. How good would that be?
Guam.
I thought you might put Sao Tome and Principe in
that
there.
That would have been too obvious.
Of course, they're going to be hosting the next World Cup.
Yeah, that would have been too obvious.
Now, yeah, I mean, the point you raise about the money is like being distributed to clubs for qualifying for this new tournament. Same with countries. There has to be, with smart people of good intent, a way of redistributing some of the wealth in football away from the apex of Europe. Because it's a global game which all contributes to Europe, but there is no reason why every corner of the game should be going hungry with the amount of money washing through football. And the Club World Cup might be one of it, the expanded World Cup's another way, and what you're saying, Muzz, is then actual programs to build the very bottom football nations to give them some taste of what's going on. I think it's incumbent upon the governing authorities to make sure everyone gets an opportunity to grow their game and it doesn't all funnel into Western Europe.
Might be a good vote winner too for Infantino in places like South America if South American clubs such as yours in Brazil, Fluminense, Harps, could make $20 million for qualifying for something like this.
Well, imagine the A-League. Imagine an A-League team winning. The Western Sydney Wanderers circa 2014. Yeah. We don't know what the format would look like, but based on our success so far, the Wanderers getting through and a $20-30 million hit from FIFA for qualifying for this thing.
Mm. Then the players go, we deserve $10 million, so that. Divide that by so we get $500,000.
That's the problem when they last qualified.
Well, you know, it's better than the wet fish slap in the face we get now, Speedy.
Righto. There is no football this weekend, as we've discussed, which means, Harps, you've got the weekend off because we know Speedy will be calling eight different sports. Any AFL for you this weekend, Speedy?
No AFL in the opening round.
Just rugby league.
I've got the day off Saturday, so I'll be able to watch my Hawks play on Saturday afternoon and then rugby league surrounds it.
Harps, what have you got planned for the weekend off?
Well, we have the annual, the 100-and-something, annual NABIAC show this weekend. Willamber and District Agricultural Society, and I'll be there.
Have you got a stall?
I'll be manning the dog jumping competition after going through the poultry exhibition.
The dog jumping, is it a height or is it a race?
No, it's a height.
Okay.
It's a height. And our Jack Russell Jones, who's injured coming into this tournament. But
I saw that on Sportsbet.
our Jack Russell Jones was equal first in the dog jumping competition at last year's NABIAC show in a field of two.
What height?
Well, not very high, but he won. He's a Jack Russell. He won the small dogs category.
Any show bags?
In a field of one.
Show bags at the NABIAC show?
Of course, everything. Sideshow alley, the whole box and dice, mate. I encourage anyone who's of the inclination to drop in and say good day. That's where I'll be. And the FIFA break came at a perfect time because I rarely get to go to my local agricultural show.
Where's Murray Shaw going on the weekend?
I am at the Football Writers Festival at Jamboree Pub, so looking forward to going down there. I think I'm the MC for the trivia night on Saturday. I'm on a panel talking about football journalism on Saturday afternoon.
Your wife
as well.
Must be delighted. A weekend with no A-League and you're going to a Football Writers Festival.
And then on Sunday we might head off with my young son to the Jamboree Recreation Park where you control the action.
What was the other? Was the other expression for that one?
What's that?
Jamboree Recreation Park. Was that when they
where
were
you
coming
control
down?
The action?
Was there another line on it?
They used to have the Scout Jamboree down there at Jamboree, and of course you'll enjoy the Johnny Warren memorabilia, which adorns most of the Jamboree pub nowadays. What a great!
Looking forward to catching up with Jamie and Ross. It should be a good weekend. All right, thanks, Speedy. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Muzz.
Enjoy your weekend.
A weekend of no football, eh?
Harps, enjoy the dog jump and enjoy the Dagwood dogs at the show.
Good on you. Go well, guys.
That's all we've got time for this week on the Baldcast. Don't forget Daniel Garb and Simon Hill will be back on Monday with a wrap of the weekend. Not quite sure what they'll talk about given the lack of football this weekend. And we'll be back same time next week. Bye for now.
And don't forget to avoid ironing your shirt. Hold that seatbelt out in front.
People in the car are doing that right now.